Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Usually it's Israeli conservatives who speak about the country in terms of threats to its existence. My next guest speaks as an Israeli liberal who also wonders if Israel is facing its undoing, but for him it would be through Israel's own actions. Gershom Gorenberg is with the liberal American Prospect magazine, blogs at southjerusalem.com, and has a new book called The Unmaking of Israel. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
Why do you see a threat from within to Israel's existence as a Jewish state?
Well, the key problems are ones deriving from the continued occupation of the West Bank and from the entanglement of religion and state. The ongoing occupation means that Israel is in control of an area that in which Jewish settlers have the vote, are members of the Israeli polity, where the surrounding Palestinian population doesn't. That in itself, as a permanent situation, contradicts Israel's own declaration of independence and original intent to be a democracy and the desire of most of its citizens to be a democracy. Within the occupied territories, the settlement effort has consistently undermined the rule of law. Countless situations in which the government itself has either ignored violations of the law or at times has taken part in what are essentially rogue operations to build settlement. The rule of law is also essential to a democracy. Permanent control of the West Bank brings the threat of a call for one person, one vote, in which case Jews would no longer be a majority in Israel, bringing an end to the project of a Jewish state. For all those reasons, this is a threat to Israel's existence as a state, as a democracy, and as a Jewish state. Moreover, what we've seen in the last 2 years, in the most recent term of the parliament, of the Knesset, is a series of legislative efforts by the right-wing coalition that are a two-pronged attack on Israel's democracy from within. One prong is an attempt to silence human rights groups, the judiciary, and anybody else who has challenged the ongoing human rights problem in the territories. And the second prong is to relate to Israel's own Arab citizens, Palestinians who live within Israel's borders and are citizens of the state, to treat them as second-class citizens, to treat them as essentially the same as Palestinians in the occupied territory, by such means as demanding loyalty oaths that are framed in such a way that it would be difficult for a Palestinian citizen to take such an oath as the condition for full civil rights.
So what do you think it would take to turn the Israeli citizenry, I guess the Jewish majority Israeli citizenry, more to your side on this? Because the trend has been in the other direction. People elected the Netanyahu government and the coalition that's currently in power, I guess out of, you know, frustration and despair that they were ever going to have a real meaningful partner for peace in the Palestinians. Otherwise, most of them probably would have elected a more liberal government and, you know, tried to go back to something like the Oslo Accords if they thought that it would actually produce peace.
Well, the situation internally is more complicated than that. Netanyahu was elected after his predecessor, Ehud Olmert, who was working for a peace agreement, was indicted on various corruption charges. Such issues not connected to foreign policy certainly affected the election. A part of the traditional Likud vote is the electorate is not as right-wing as the base which chose the Knesset list and the candidate, a phenomenon certainly known elsewhere, including in this country. So what's really happened over the past 18 years since Oslo is that the Israeli electorate has swung strongly back and forth. There's a wide center that both sees the need for a two-state solution and is suspicious of the costs needed for it. I think that in a situation where the risks to Israel itself and the developing international isolation become more clear to the electorate, there's certainly a chance of electoral change in the future. In any case, as a journalist and as a historian, I don't see my position as being writing about what is happening is not dependent on exactly how many votes that position has. The journalist's position is to show the situation
and as a historian,
to let people decide on that basis.
As a historian, you write a lot in this book about what happened in the earliest days of the Jewish state to set up conditions today, sometimes without intending to. For example, decisions that led to a large, impoverished Orthodox population. Take us back to those.
Okay, so what happened was when the State of Israel was established, there was a very small ultra-Orthodox population in the state. I specifically use the term ultra-Orthodox or the Hebrew term Haredi. This is the wing of Orthodoxy that seeks to separate itself from modern society and had not been part of the Zionist movement. When the state was established, it began, one of its first steps was creating a free educational system. It continued to work for the first few years through party-linked, politically-linked educational systems that had existed in the pre-state Jewish community in British-ruled Palestine, and added to that system a ultra-Orthodox system. And the state didn't worry too much about funding ultra-Orthodox schools because it was presumed at that time that ultra-Orthodoxy had only a few years left to survive. It had been shrinking radically. But what the state funding did is that it allowed a situation in which young women could finish teacher seminaries literally before the age of 20, get teaching jobs, which were then well paid, and get married and support a husband who continued to study Torah, continued to study religious texts deep into adulthood. This was the beginning of the transformation of the ultra-Orthodox community from a community that had the same birth rate, the same employment rate, the same marriage age as the rest of the Jewish community into a community today in which the majority of men never hold jobs their entire life, in which the average family size is much, much larger than the rest of the Jewish society, and the marriage age hovers around 20. The result of this is a growing economic crisis among the ultra-Orthodox themselves, a huge economic drain on the country itself, and the continued funding by the state of the education system of a community that does not include either basic economic skills or the basic intellectual skills for participating in a democratic society.
Do you see that as
an economic threat? It's harming the potential for a large part of the population to be an informed electorate. And in the long term, it's very damaging to Israeli society.
Do you see it as relevant to the Israeli-Palestinian stalemate?
Well, it's relevant in the following sense, which is that one of the reasons that ultra-Orthodox parties continue to be part of the coalition is that they are part of the coalition supporting the right on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And since 1967, since the Israeli conquest of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, et cetera, in what was an unplanned but essentially defensive war, the future of those territories has been the overwhelming single issue in Israeli politics. By being part of the right-wing coalition, the ultra-Orthodox parties are able to continue asking for the ever larger funds that their community needs from the state to survive. And at the same time, because the conflict is ongoing, it leads to a relationship in the Jewish majority, an attitude in the Jewish majority of seeing the Arab minority within Israel as potentially disloyal, the exclusion of Arab-backed parties from coalitions, and that, too, increases the bargaining power of the ultra-Orthodox parties.
So in our last minute, what would you suggest Israel do, if anything, to reverse the state and religion trends that you're concerned about?
Well, one step is, again, that a peaceful solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict will open up the political debate within Israel. The second step is that the state needs to immediately require that all schools teach a core curriculum that includes the skills needed for a modern life. And there's a need to disestablish the state rabbinate, which today controls marriage and divorce, and allow Israelis the choice of which form of religious expression they would like, something which would be better both for the state and for Judaism itself.
Gershom Gorenberg is with the Liberal American Prospect magazine. He blogs at southjerusalem.com, and he has a new book called The Unmaking of Israel. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
And now, your one-minute performances about performances. Any performances you have recently seen, like over this weekend in theaters or clubs. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, if you want to take a crack at this. Now that we're all back in our weekly Monday grinds, even for a three-day week, let's talk about what culture we took in over the weekend. I want to know what performances you're telling your friends about. But more specifically, I want to know how you're telling your friends about them, or tell us about them. The way you went home and told your friend or your wife or your parents or your kids or whoever you've been talking to about that thing you saw that was amazing or that was terrible. 212-433-9692. Here's what I mean. Sometimes we see one of those performances that is so good or so bad that when we explain them to our friends, we start to recreate the performance, right? We start to do a performance of the performance. On November 13th, the theater and opera director Peter Sellers was in conversation with sculptor Anish Kapoor and composer Brian Eno at the New York Public Library. And this is what inspired this call-in, because here is how Sellers put it. And this is a minute long, courtesy of Fora TV.
What I love about theater is not what people experience during the piece, but the next morning somebody calls up a friend who they love and say, I saw this horrible thing last night. And they go on for a half hour describing it. And or they say, I saw this beautiful thing last night. It doesn't matter, it's the same half hour. And somebody who didn't see it begins to imagine it. The person who was there becomes themselves a creative being and actually describe something to someone who hasn't seen something. And in the process of that, they're activated as artists. And then this third person goes and tells another person about something they didn't see, which is so beautiful and so completely satisfying. And this idea that, in fact, what we're doing in the arts is not creating objects, but creating the legend.
Peter Sellers, the director. So you get the idea. Now we want to take his inspiration and activate you as artists to talk about whatever works of art, performance or otherwise, you have seen. So 212-433-WNYC for the last 10 minutes of our show today. 212-433-9692. And we will take those calls. Your one-minute performances about any performances that you have recently seen. We will take those calls right after this.